This is an ABC podcast.
Are you ready to hear about Alexis Wright's Carpenteria? Hi, it's Kate Evans here from RN's weekly fiction review program, The Bookshelf. And here on ABC Listen, we've brought together important literary discussions from the Radio National Archives, conversations with some of Australia's most significant writers. So let's turn our attention to author Alexis Wright with this 2008 conversation she had with Ursula Raymond on Away. Just the year before, 2007, Wright had won the Miles Franklin Award for her epic novel, Carpenteria, which is set in and around the mythical town of Desperance in Queensland's Gulf Country, the traditional land of Wright's grandmother, the Wanyi people, and also the site of a great conflict with a multinational mining company. The novel chronicles the stories and lives of those involved in this fight. And the interview begins with Alexis Wright reading from her novel.
An ancient chant, but we know your story already. The bells peal everywhere. Church bells calling the faithful to the tabernacle where the gates of heaven will open, but not for the wicked. Calling innocent little black girls from a distant community where the white dove bearing an olive branch never lands. Little girls who come back home after church on Sunday, who look around themselves at the human fallout and announce matter-of-factly, Armageddon begins here. The ancient serpent, a creature larger than storm clouds, came down from the stars, laden with its own creative enormity. It moved graciously, if you had been watching with the eyes of a bird, hovering in the sky far above the ground. Looking down at the serpent's wet body, glistening from an ancient sunlight, long before man was a creature who could contemplate the next moment in time. It came down those billions of years ago to crawl on its heavy belly all around the wet clay soils in the Gulf of Carpentaria. Picture the creative serpent soaring deep into, scoring down through the slippery underground of the mudflats, leaving in its wake the thunder of tunnels collapsing to form deep sunken valleys. The seawater following in the serpent's wake, swarming in a frenzy of tidal waves, soon changed colour from ocean blue to the yellow of mud. The water filled the swirling tracks to form the mighty bending rivers spread across the vast plains of the Gulf Country. The serpent travelled over the marine plains, over the salt flats, through the sand dunes, past the mangrove forests and crawled inland. Then it went back to the sea, and it came out at another spot along the coastline and crawled inland and back again. When it finished creating the many rivers in its wake, it created one last river, no larger or smaller than the others, a river which offers no apologies for its discontent with people who do not know it. This is where the giant serpent continues to live, deep down under the ground, in a vast network of limestone aquifers. They say its being is porous. It permeates everything. It is all around in the atmosphere and is attached to the lives of the river people like skin. This tidal river snake of flowing mud takes in breaths of a size that is difficult to comprehend. Imagine the serpent's breathing rhythms as the tide flows inland, edging towards the spring waters nestled deeply in the gorges of an ancient limestone plateau, covered with rattling grasses dried yellow from the prevailing winds. Then with the outward breath, the tide turns and the serpent flows back to its own circulating mass of shallow waters in a giant water basin in a crook of the mainland whose sides separate it from the open sea. It's a bit difficult to describe in a very short way. I've written a very long essay about Carpenteria, and I still think about the book and what some of the ideas and things that were going through my mind when I was writing it. Look, it's a book set in the Gulf of Carpenteria. It deals a lot with the country up that part of the world, the landscape and the sea as well. There's a lot in the book about fishing and climate and what the country means to us in a traditional sense, in the best way that someone like myself could work with what I'm able to know. And the book is about relationships between people and relationships that are old relationships, ancient relationships between one another as Indigenous people, and also relationships that have been formed since colonial times with establishments of towns and mines and things like that in our traditional areas.
There's lots of tensions in those relationships that you describe.
Yes, there are lots of tensions in the relationships because there's a lot of unresolved issues between us and between our worlds. I wanted to write a book that talked about us as people who, you know, how we think, how we feel, a bit different to the academic kind of versions of Indigenous Australia. I wanted to, to talk about, us as people and trying to think about the question of integrity, how we can live as people, with integrity in today's world, given that there's so many issues and things that we're dealing with, unresolved issues. Carlos Fuentes, the Mexican writer, I looked at a lot of writers from across the world in trying to understand how I could write this book. And he said of Mexico, his native land, all times in Mexico have never been resolved. All times are important and no time has ever been resolved. And this is, we have the same situation here, from our ancient times, to colonial times until today, that huge stories have been made that affect us and are relevant to us. And so we're dealing with stories from all times. And I also thought about, our old world, our traditional world is, that's still within us, whether, we're people who are, in the top end of Australia in remote communities, living a more traditional lifestyle, to people who are living in urban areas, the spirit of who we are is still within us and it affects the way that we think and do things. And I call it ancient passion, old love.
Just reading it, and you mentioned Carlos Fuentes, but it reminded me also of Gabriel Garcia Marquez and Isabel Allende, just in terms of the colour that's in it and the movement, and there's just so much.
Oh, look, I did look at writers from across the world, the Latin American writers and Asian writers, African writers, European writers, people who have had, who still live in their own country, have had that unbroken connection to the ancient world of their place, and that I felt I needed to understand. I couldn't find it here in literature in Australia. I couldn't find terribly much that could help me understand how I could write this book, and so I had to look at those writers. And
so you needed that to write.
I needed that, yes, to understand how to write a contemporary Aboriginal novel that, has a background in our ancient literature. And I wanted to know how other people did that, from other parts of the world. And like the French Caribbean writers, I really like Patrick Chemisay, his big book called Texaco, and another book called Solobo Magnificent, which is the storyteller, the death of a storyteller. And a lot of what he writes about resonates with our world.
Would you say it's an easy book to read?
Some people say it's a difficult book, more academic. People might say it's difficult, but it's different. I wanted to write a book that was sort of as authentic as I could make it of our world. I mean, if it's my version of it, it's not everybody's version of what is authentic, to our Indigenous world. But as I see it as a writer, and as I've put a lot of thought into the book, I was asking a lot of questions about things that were troubling me about our world and how I felt, very concerned about our future as a people. So it wasn't meant to be easy, because it's not, our world is not easy. And this is, my portrayal, of a particular world. I mean, it's not everything. I could write probably another book and deal with a lot of other questions that are not dealt with in this book. And it could be, just as complex. Or I could write a simple story. But there's a lot written about us in newspapers, and it's very one-sided. You don't hear a lot of Aboriginal voices. And particularly in the time that I was writing this book, there wasn't a lot of Aboriginal people whose voices were heard in the media. And there wasn't much from our side. And I thought, well, Carpentariat, whether it's published or not published, it's kind of a document, a manuscript of this particular time. Our kids go looking in 20 years' time, or their children's children, they can look back at this time, and when they go through all the newspaper clippings and things like that and think, well, what were they thinking of? Mm. And where didn't they even speak? And, our mob. And, well, You know, they might look at carpentry in particular in our area and say, well, this is something that we had anyway. And this is something of what people were thinking about in the year 2000, you know, or thereabouts.
How long did it take you to write?
Well, it took 2 years of thinking how I could write this book. And I had a lot of things, you know, personally, you know, emotionally to sort out, because I was quite caught up in the world of trying to prevent the mining from happening on our traditional domain, the Big Century mine. There was a lot of protests and a lot of negotiations.
And that's where,
I don't know if the idea came from there. I knew I wanted to write a book. I knew it couldn't be a book about mining and a novel about not mining. You couldn't write a novel about just simply mining. I couldn't write the real story. I felt I was too emotionally involved.
This is on your clan estate, the wine, your wine.
Yes.
This is in Gulf of Carpentaria.
That's right. So I felt that I couldn't write the real story because I was too close to it, and in a way that, you know, perhaps I couldn't have dealt with it in the way that it should be dealt with. Yeah, without being sued, perhaps. So, you know, because to tell the real truth of what happened and how, you know, and my interpretation of how I saw people act towards some of our people, particularly Murundu Yenna and people like Clarence Walden, people who stood up and really fought for what they believed in. And I saw a lot of people put the people like Murundu down, and who shouldn't have made it very difficult for him. And
can you just give us a snapshot of what was actually happening at that time?
Oh, look, before that, prior to those 2 years that I had to think about how I could write the book, there was a lot of protests to try to prevent the big multinational mining company, the biggest of its type in the world, to be being developed on our traditional domain.
And what were they wanting to mine there?
Lead, zinc. But there was a lot of concern about the use of groundwater, the environment and the social impact, and the environmental impact to the sea in the Gulf. People like Murundu Yenna spearheaded a lot of protests to try to slow that development down, to make people understand about some of the issues that we were concerned about. And in fact, you know, a lot of people didn't want the mine to be developed. And then it caused, a lot of friction between our own people over the development of the mine.
So some wanted it, some didn't.
Yes, and there were reasons for both sides. I mean, you could understand that. And so there were a lot of negotiations and a lot of people stepped into that process, people in high places, you know, and there were difficulties created, unnecessary difficulties and very little understanding. But, you know, when you look at our Indigenous world and it's, you know, it's just one of many similar difficulties that we've had in trying to have other people understand who we are as people and what matters to us as people in terms of, you know, trying to care for country and what the problem is with damaging country. But, yes, I was very concerned about all what was happening, and it did affect me.
And, what effect?
Oh, look, it's an emotional effect, you know, a great sadness to see the trouble that this development of this mine caused huge issues. Just seeing that, and because, you know, I feel very passionately about the Gulf and, you know, I learned, you know, about feeling for our country from my grandmother at a very early age. I spent a lot of time with my grandmother. I used to run away to live with her when I was from the time I was about three. And she used to take me all around the bush and the rivers and that around Cloncurry where I grew up. And she'd tell stories at night and she'd be talking to people all the time. And all the time she would always talk about wanting to go back up and, you know, to the Gulf, to Louis Creek at Lawn Hill and where, you know, she was born and grew up and, you know, where her mother was, you know, when my mother grew up. So as a small child, hearing her talk and talk about, you know, cultural things too, about ways of seeing the world, and I think that opened my imagination to, it was a place that developed a longing in my heart and in my spirit, I think, you know, because I loved her dearly and it was her longing. I think it made it easy for me as an adult then to live and work in our world and to try and understand it, to always be open to the stories of our world. And that's what affected me, you know, is the land, what was going to happen to our country, the spirits of the country, to the people. So, yes, I felt very hurt and very hurt to see the troubles that it created between families.
But the mine's gone ahead now, and those people took a stand. And what's the result now? I mean, have those issues been resolved? I mean, they fought a hard fight and they seem to have lost it.
Look, life goes on. I haven't been up there for some time, so I can't speak for how people feel now about the mine or about, you know, some of the tensions that were caused. But I would imagine that those tensions, you know, can resurface at any time if anything blows up. You know, we've seen this in the territory with the Howard government intervention and how it has created tensions between Indigenous people in the territory, and to the point where people are criticising one another and condemning, you know, one another. It's not good. And I would imagine those tensions would take some time to be resolved. That wasn't created by us. That was created by the Howard government.
So did you mean to win the Miles Franklin Award?
No, not at all. I had no idea that this book would do as well as it has done. It's been an unbelievable year. It's it ended up picking up 5 major literary awards, and one on top of the other. Any moment could have been a wonderful moment to really savour. I love writing, but it was a hard book to write, and had a lot of false starts. I threw away a lot of early drafts, and then was working on a draft when I finally realised how it should be written, so I had to go back again and change it all into this type of voice that it should be written in, and then working over and over and over until I felt that it was right. It took 6 years, and in the end, I was dreaming the manuscript. Oh. And and it was, you know, hundreds of pages of manuscripts, and trying to remember what was on each page in my dreams and to correct it. And that I was always worried about mistakes, and they could be anywhere. And then when I finally let the manuscript go, it should have been a day of celebration, but I cried all day. I'd lived with this world that I was creating in this book, you know, for so long. I was living in two worlds, my real world in Alice Springs and the relationships with people I have there and what I was doing, and also the world of the book. So the world of the book and Norm Fantham and his family and Mozzie Fishman, they all were, I was saying, you know, I had to say goodbye, this is it. And they were people that I liked. And so I was not going to be with them anymore. And so, yes, I cried all day. It was very sad. And I think it took a year mentally and physically to get over the writing of this book.
Wow. Mm-hmm. So did it send you a bit mad, do you think?
I think so. Yeah, a bit crazy. Because it's a big book, and I try to give it everything that I could give.
And your family at this time? I mean, how are they going through all this process? And
Look, no, my family are quite used to me, the way I am. So, no, they're very good. They're very supportive. I have a very supportive husband. But I think it took its toll because, you know, he was doing a lot of the supporting, you know, in terms of, you know, maybe I should have been earning a wage, a good wage, and like everybody else, and helping to look after the family, and he bore a lot of that responsibility. But no, I didn't expect the book to win the Miles Franklin or any other awards. It took after I finished the book, it took I think just about every major publisher in Australia turned it down. So I knew when I was writing the book, I was taking major risks in the way that I was doing it, in writing it in a storytelling fashion that I thought it suited our world, but it didn't suit the literary publishing world of Australia. So I felt quite disappointed and sad by that. I thought perhaps at some stage that I might have to give the manuscript to Carpentaria Land Council to archive, you know, for another day, and, you know, just even if it never ever got published. But it was a very brave publisher in the end who decided to publish the book. My publisher, Gerimondo, with Ivor Indic, he chooses to publish, you know, very very few books. He's only a very small publisher, but he's very, very, very good. He's one of the best people, I think, literary people in the country. I felt really good that when he finally accepted the manuscript, because he read the manuscript and then he came back and asked me It sent me an email asking me some really hard questions about why I wrote the book the way that I did. And I thought, well, he's not going to publish it. And I answered the questions as best I could, but I thought, why should he publish it? He has to get his money back, you know. Why should he take the risk that I've taken? But he came back and, he just worked with me solidly on getting the book ready to be published, and has backed it every all the way. And he continues to back the book and to support me. But winning prizes was just an unbelievable thing to happen. It's been a big year.
Alexis Wright speaking to Ursula Raymond in 2008 on RN's Away programme about her epic novel Carpenteria, a book both influential and lauded. I'm Kate Evans, and I do hope you enjoyed this journey into the RN archives. There are more in this series, so make sure you follow The Bookshelf on the ABC Listen app for stories like this and for review discussions of the latest Australian and international fiction.